The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the first and number one global fintech podcast and radio show, the longest running fintech podcast and radio show in the world as well. I'm your host, Brett King. We are going to be live from LendIt conference in New York shortly. But before that, we have a few conference announcements to get through. Next week, March 16, I'm going to be down in Miami for the Temenos Innovation Jam. Join me down there if you can. The information on the Temenos Innovation Jam is on the Breaking Banks website as well. And on March 22nd, our good pal Dave Birch will be doing the Temenos Innovation Jam in London. So we've had LendIt USA this week in the Javits Center. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. But Findeavor is the next big conference coming up in New York City on March 21st and 22nd. This is the developer conference for Finovate. So you can use the code BBanksDevR20 and get a 20% discount today. And don't forget that Innovate Finance is in London on April 10th and the 11th. That is the Innovate Finance Global Summit. And I'll be speaking there as well as judging the startup panels that are there. You can check out all of these conferences on our partners page at breakingbanks.com, and they'll be listed there along with the discount code. Now, up for this week, we had the LendIt conference in the Javits Center. It is the largest lending-focused fintech conference in the world right now. They expected attendance of around 5,800 people at the event. It was packed. There were people from China and all around the world to talk about micro-lending and microfinancing and P2P and stuff. And we thought we would check out some of the great stuff that's happening here. We started off on Tuesday morning with me doing an interview with Anthony Jenkins on the main stage of the LendIt conference. And if you guys know Anthony Jenkins, he was the CEO at Barclays not that long ago. He left Barclays and he's now heading up his own fintech startup called 10X Future Technologies. So this is a discussion that we had on the main stage, the morning keynote at LendIt conference on Tuesday morning.
Here right now we have the former CEO of Barclays, Anthony Jenkins, who has flown all the way from London to be here today. He is now the CEO of 10X Future Technologies, and he's trying now to really transform banking from the outside. And here to interview him is the one of my favorite podcasts, the host of Breaking Banks and the CEO of Moovin. Please welcome Brett King and Anthony Jenkins.
Hey, thanks for having us. All right, so I'm sure Anthony doesn't need any introduction, but you've come from the beast of the belly, Anthony. You know, you were a banker, and can I ask you, when was the moment that you realized that it was all changing and you had to be a part of whatever this new space was going to be?
Well, 35 years in the industry, there's so much technology in banking, but why doesn't it ever make a difference? Why hasn't it really changed banking in the way that you see in other industries, whether it's content, shopping, travel, those types of things? And I was asking myself that question at Barclays. I think we did a lot of great stuff in trying to move the organization forward. But it was clear to me that the technology was changing very fast, and it was hard to move the organization at the same pace. So when I left, I spent a lot of time looking at what was going on in fintech. Looked at over 400 fintech companies. I met with 50 different ones, trying to figure out what was going on in the landscape. But it just seemed to me that we'd come to a point where the technology sophistication and its cost had reached the point where it could create true transformation in the industry. And that's really why I've decided in the next phase of my career to work on things that are about that transformation.
So how many of you would identify yourself as part of an incumbent or a traditional financial services company? Right, how many of you would identify yourself as part of a startup or a fintech or a technology support? Okay, so it seems like about half and half of the audience here. Now, we just heard from Alex, of course, on blockchain and how that's changing things in the world. So, but blockchain is just one of the technologies that we see that has the potential to be really revolutionary and sort of change a lot about what we're doing here. So, is this about sort of a partial application of technology into specific areas? Is it a first principles reboot of financial services? Are we going to end up with something completely different, or is it something in between?
So I think it's probably all of the above. In my view, this is going to have a number of different waves that will happen over time. And there's no doubt that the industry, particularly in the developed world, has done a lot to incrementally embrace new technology. But as I said before, it never really made a difference until mobile came along, because mobile means that you can now carry your bank in your pocket. And so certainly in Europe, and particularly in the UK, we're seeing significant declines in traffic in branches, for example, because people would much rather bank on their phone.
Who would have seen that coming, I guess?
Indeed. People have been predicting that for years. I remember I was here in the 90s, and through the first internet wave, and everybody's saying, oh, there won't be any bank branches left and stuff. And then, of course, in the early 2000s, it seemed like every other corner of Manhattan right. was a bank branch or a Starbucks.
Yeah.
So we're in the first wave, and this is where you get a lot of incremental progress being made. You also get some important building blocks being established by the non-incumbents. And so what I think is interesting about peer-to-peer lending is not that we're lending billions of dollars through peer-to-peer. It's that we've established that it's possible to lend money without bank intermediation. That's a really important thing, because at the end of the day, all banks do is intermediate. If it was just you and I in the world, you had money, I needed money, you'd lend me the money, we'd agree the terms, sure. Who needs a bank, right? But because there's hundreds of millions of people in this country, billions of people in the world, we've created this banking system. So now, if I want to borrow money, you effectively lend money to your bank. That goes through a set of complex central mechanisms to my bank, where I borrow the money. So in the next wave, I think, some of these principles that are being established will start to come together. And for me, the most important technologies that are out there right now are distributed ledger technologies in all of its variants, and everything that's going on with machine learning and artificial intelligence. Why? Because it allows finally to deliver a much more powerful experience for the customer. And for me, it's possible in my sort of third wave of this, which I would see as being a sort of 10 to 20 year wave,
yep.
to imagine a fundamental re-architecting of the system using these technologies to create a much lower cost, much faster, much more effective and safer banking system. You do that by taking out the intermediation function. So if you're a pension fund and you want long-term liabilities, you can use distributed ledger technology to connect to people who want mortgages. You can also use machine learning and AI and all of that to match the people together with the same risk appetite, risk profile, and so on. So for me, you can see that happening in a 10 to 20 year time frame. And when that happens, the system is going to fundamentally change. In the meantime, there'll be lots of progress along the way, and as we know, also lots of missteps.
Now, of course, you've been dominantly based in the UK for your recent career, but we've seen some interesting stuff happening there. We've got some of these neobanks emerging, Starling and Monzo, Adam and others coming out there. You know, you talk about P2P, of course, Zopa, the first real P2P platform came out of the UK. We always have this sort of competition between New York and the UK in terms of fintech, and always sort of talking about different stats to prove who's the number one fintech center. But do you think that we're going to see that third phase or stage of this transformation occur in a developed market, or could it come out of developing economies?
So we were actually talking about this before we came on. I think some of the most interesting work is going on in the developing world. We were talking about M-Pesa in Kenya. I've spent a lot of time in Kenya. Basically, it's a whole banking system based on what we would call feature phones, not even smartphones.
Yeah.
And of course, WeChat and Tencent have done a fantastic job in China. Of course, it's so much easier to do something new when you don't have any legacy that's pulling you back. And of course, creating something is better than having nothing. So again, I think there are lessons that can be learned from the developing world. But I still see massive opportunity in the developed economies because the financial services sector is the biggest sector of any developed economy, and it doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well for the end users. It doesn't work very well for banks, frankly, because their return on equity is pretty poor. And 8 years on from the crisis, can we really say that the system is as safe as we want to be? There's no doubt that it's safer, but is as safe as we would like it to be. So taking some of these learnings from around the world and putting them together in the way that fast-moving transformation happens is what's going to drive this. And I think there's lessons from the developing world and from the developed world.
So tell me about your startup that you've got, 10X Future Technologies. Tell me where you got the idea for it and what you guys are trying to accomplish.
So when I sort of moved out of the official banking world, there were many things that I could have done, but I was fascinated by this transformation, which I always believed was going to happen, and wanted to be part of it. So I began to think about what would a completely new banking system look like, and not one that was just a bit better, but one that was 10 times better. What would that feel like to the customer? What would it feel like to the bank? What would it feel like for society? And I thought about what technologies could we use to deliver that kind of transformation? And we initially started to think about, well, could we use distributed ledger? Our conclusion was it was a bit too soon for that. But we began to put together a small team and start to really understand the problem we were trying to solve. Now, the problem we're trying to solve is not that there aren't smart people in banks, committed people, there's not those fantastic resources and great knowledge, brand, and all of those things. It's that it's very, very difficult for incumbent players to transform themselves.
So let me just drill down that for a second, and I want to come back to the tech. But is it your position that in respect to this technology transformation, that a fintech or a startup like you've built has a speed and cost advantage to an incumbent in terms of deploying the tech?
Yes. And the reason why is not, it's not a kind of mechanical thing. It's actually as much a cultural thing as anything else.
Right.
And I know because I used to deal with these issues. Again, it's not that there's bad intent or lack of imagination, but when you're very familiar with doing things in a certain way and the organization is architected around that, it is very hard to change it. It's human behavior. When cloud computing comes along and all you've ever done is run mainframe and mid-range data centers, it's a sort of strange idea that it's hard to get your head around. And this is why it's very rare to find incumbents who truly build the next wave of service in any industry vertical. Now, in addition to the cultural problem, of course, banks themselves are weighed down by massive technology estates that go back, to the 60s in some cases, hardware and software, huge costs to keep the lights on with those systems, and then, of course, a huge wave of regulatory change, which is putting more strain on the system. So it's very, very difficult for banks to innovate. And when I set up 10X, what I wanted to do was build a completely clean, transformational platform, which does three things. One, it's designed to really understand what customers want from financial services and to deliver it in a modern, contemporary way. When people say, what does that feel like? I say, take your phone out, look at the two or three apps you love on your phone. That's what it should feel like.
Yeah.
And I challenge you today, pull out your phone, look at your banking app. Is that in the top two or three? I don't think so. Secondarily, could we create a super integrated data architecture? Because really all financial services products are data, right? I mean, more than anything else actually in life, it's just information moving backwards and forwards. And part of the problem for banks today is that that data is completely chopped up across multiple different systems, databases. And so we spent a lot of time building a data architecture to deliver the sort of services I was describing. And then, of course, you've got to have the tech to support all of that. And the tech we're using, I would describe as modern, but it's not completely out there. And we're now in the process of building the platform. The platform will largely be complete by the end of the year, and we'll begin to deploy it next year.
So your role as bending space and time for incumbents to help them get on top of these new technologies faster, or?
Yeah, actually, when I started off, I didn't believe that many, if any, incumbents would be interested in what I was doing, because it is, you know, bending time, as you said. But actually, what I've sensed among the bank CEOs that I know and talk to is there's now a realization that they have to do something different. And the difference now is, okay, I still got to keep my digital programs running over here, but if I'm going to really respond to the existential threat, I need to do something different over here. So I'm going to greenfield this thing, use a platform like 10x, stand it up, make it work, and then I've got choices. So then I can choose to migrate over, I can run this in a particular product line or geography, but I've got choices. It's really the only solution for the incumbents. But frankly, we've been approached by many other parties about 10x. The private equity world is very interested in it because, you know, when they buy and sell financial services businesses, they're always looking for something that can step their cost base down dramatically. And frankly, we've also been approached by some non-banks who are looking to get into financial services and like the fact that they can just kind of connect our services to their digital customer base.
So you know, we often talk about fintech versus incumbent, and I asked that question of you guys earlier for a purpose. Do you think we're now starting to see sort of this merger between these two worlds where collaboration and cooperation is becoming a key theme, particularly for fintechs who are looking for revenue?
Yeah, I think financial services is so big and complex. There's lots of opportunity in there. There's opportunity for banks to kind of deliver the sort of incremental change I described. There's opportunity for pure play standalone fintechs, although as we're finding, it costs a lot of money to build a brand in financial services and to acquire customers. There's lots of opportunity for collaboration, but it's not as easy as it looks. And I'm sure there are some fintech businesses out there who have been working with banks, you know, and they had a very nice conversation with
There's
the
one
CEO.
Right here.
18 months ago, and they're still talking to somebody in compliance about
exactly.
it. You know, maybe some of the, you know, there's a lady Laffy on the front. She's been through this experience. And, you know, in 3 years' time, you might have some MVP out there, by which time, of course, everything will have moved on and be completely different. So collaboration is not as easy as it looks. Again, it's not because there's bad intent in the banks. It's just they're not architected for innovation. And then I think more kind of transformational plays like the one we're working on will definitely have a place to play. Frankly, I applaud any innovation in the category because I think it's good. And what we saw from the early days of the internet was the first things out of the gate weren't the ones that necessarily won. I mean, Google wasn't the first search engine out there. You know, Facebook wasn't the first social media. So it's the organizations that can solve the problem better, often by building on the work that people that have gone before them have done.
Absolutely.
And that's the phase that we're in now. It's what I like to think of as the end of the beginning. We've had, you know, the fintech, we've had the financial crisis, we've had technologies changing very profoundly, mobile, 4G, cloud, started machine learning, AI, distributed ledger, and we've had the rise of the fintechs. All of this is just the end of the beginning. What comes next is going to be profound.
Yeah, if you work for a fintech and you're trying to collaborate with banks, you could be forgiven for thinking it's the procurement's job to kill your business. But anyway, so I'm interested in the cycle in terms of development of 10x. Where are you at in that, and when will you sort of be out to market with? I know you've got the platform stood up now, but when will your first major release be out there?
Yeah, so we invested a lot of time in the design of the data architecture and the platform because that really is where the problem is solved, right?
Yep.
It's quite easy to stand up a pretty basic cloud core banking thing, but that's not what we're doing. So we've done that. We're now deep in the engineering of the platform, and that will complete pretty much by the end of the year. And so we expect to be in market around the middle of next year.
Yep. Now, you were at the helm of Barclays, of course, and you know the industry very well. So if you were the CEO of a major bank today, you hadn't decided to go off into the fintech thing, what would you be doing right now?
I would continue to try and firstly educate my organization on just how profound this threat is. And I know how difficult that is, because in 2010, I stood up in front of the retail bank in Barclays and said, I've got news for you, your world is going to change. And they looked at me like I was mad, because the whole business was based on bricks and mortar and people.
Right.
Now, of course, technology has begun to change that. So firstly, it's about sensitizing people inside the organization. But frankly, if you're running a big bank, you just don't have time for people to get it. So you have to make some radical moves. And that involves, in my view, setting up some greenfield operations completely outside, ring-fence them from the existing, partner with the fintechs if that's going to help you get there faster. But again, to your point, you've got to build a big fat wall between that set of activities and the procurement department, because as soon as procurement or internal audit or any of these, they're all well-meaning and they've all got their jobs to do, as soon as they start to get involved, it just kills the thing dead. So that's the bold.
Anyone from procurement here, by the way? So we got one last question to finish off. What are the skills that are going to matter over the next 5 to 10 years? Obviously, we've got enough bankers in the banking industry, yeah. And we've got enough credit loan officers and risk officers and things like that. What are the skills that people should be investing in?
Yeah. So I think there's basically three categories of skills that you need to do this work. Firstly, there's three categories of skills and one very important mindset. The three categories are, firstly, you have to be able to think about the customer in a profound way, right? You have to be able to reimagine the customer experience, going from what is really financial services about. At the end of the day, it's about solving problems in your life if you're an individual, right? It's not about the mortgage, it's about buying the house. It's not about the loan, it's about buying the car. It's not about the IRA, it's about retirement. So you need that kind of set of skills, really deep customer experience skills. The second thing you need is you need domain expertise. This is not a vertical where you can go at it if you don't understand what you're doing. It's just too complicated. But I'll come back to that. And the third is you need a deep understanding of the technology, not only where it is today, but where it's going. And you know, if you all out there in the audience take one thing away from today, it's spend some time investing in understanding what's going on with the technology. Not just things like distributed ledger, but things like voice, which I think is going to be big. And finally, though, in addition to those three buckets of skills, the most important thing you have to have, whether you're coming from a fintech, from an existing bank, from a company like ours, is you've got to have a radical mindset, because the future is not going to be the same as the past. Yeah. It's going to be non-linear, and you have to be able to think of the world that way.
Well, Anthony, thanks for sharing your insights with us. Just before we head off, how can people find out about 10X Future Technologies?
10xbanking.com is our website. It's numerals 10, letter X, banking.com.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for being here today.
So we're Kit Lendit, and we're here with Brock Blake and Ben Davis, who are both from the company Glendio. So Brock, let me start with you, because you are the CEO and the founder of Glendio. So obvious question, what is Glendio and what brings you to Lendit?
Yeah, so Glendio is a small business loan marketplace. We have about 75 lenders on our platform. It's kind of like the Kayak for business loans. So for a business owner, you can go to one place, fill out one application, and get access to many lenders, and then comparison shop which loan options are the best fit for you.
That's very cool. So how did you go about getting 75 lenders onto the platform?
Well, it was a little bit of us recruiting some lenders, and then a little bit of screening out which lenders we wanted on our platform. A lot of lenders coming to us saying, hey, we want volume, and we want to get more loans and do it through your customer acquisition platform. And so we've probably looked at maybe 300 lenders to get to 75. And we're constantly trying to figure out which lenders add a unique loan product that would be beneficial to a small business owner.
So when did you start Lendio, and sort of how mature is the business in terms of what you're putting through the marketplace?
So we are 6 years into it. We started this in 2011, and we've funded about just under $500 million on our platform. So that's growing. 2 years ago, it was $128 million. Last year, it was just under $250 million. And we expect to continue to see that type of growth again in 2017.
Very cool. And where are you at in your funding cycle as a startup?
So we are venture-backed. Our last round was in Q4 of 2016, and we raised $20 million from Comcast Ventures, who led it, and Stereo Capital. And we've got a great board, and we're excited about what that capital will allow us to do as far as growth.
And talking about growth, can you give us an idea of the size of the team that you have at Lendio?
We have about 125 employees. We have our main headquarters is in Salt Lake City, and then we have a satellite office here in New York as well.
And where are you based?
Salt Lake City.
Okay, well, welcome to New York.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so now you guys have come up with quite an interesting model in terms of how to grow the business. So,
Let me give you a quick overview, and then I'll turn the time over to Ben. We have a few different ways to create awareness for small business owners. One is through partnerships. We have large partnerships like Staples is a big partner of ours. Another is through direct marketing. And one of the challenges that we identified was that it's difficult to create awareness to small business owners in local geographic communities. It's kind of like the cell phone coverage map. You know, in the cities and in the urban areas, it's very great coverage. But as you seep into Main Street America, maybe it's a little bit more challenging. It's kind of the same thing with awareness. And we have felt like there was an opportunity to penetrate those markets through a unique model, and that model is through franchising. So we have individuals that will be owners of Lendio in a certain geographic region, and they will be working with their local community, accountants and attorneys and chambers of commerce and insurance agents, to be able to identify any small business owners in that area that need financing. And then they leverage all the technology that we've already built around the application process, the matches to which lenders they're a good fit for, managing the offer process. So it's this marriage of, fintech and the technology with being able to penetrate local communities. And we just launched it, and we're very excited about it.
So I guess franchising is quite a novel approach. I've not heard of franchising in the fintech space. So it makes you guys the McDonald's of fintech, I guess, or lending. But tell me the story of how this all got started. How did you come up with this idea?
So before we launched Lendio, I had started a company that was called Funding Utah. And what we were doing, we were connecting entrepreneurs to angel investors and venture capitalists. And I didn't have any marketing dollars or any other way to acquire customers. And I went out and I did this. I met with accountants and attorneys and chambers of commerce. And I created this event called speed pitching, which is like speed dating. And I realized that there were so many business owners that needed financing, one. But angel investing wasn't the right approach. Most of these business owners were Main Street. Two, I had experienced that, we were getting 50 to 100 business owners in that local geographic region a month coming to us saying, I need financing. And it wasn't from big radio campaigns or other, unique direct marketing. It was from a network we built. And so because I had lived that, I always felt like there was an opportunity once we got Lendio up and running and the technology established and the process and the systems, there would be a way to be able to take what we learned in the past and apply it here. And, you know, franchising is a unique, structured, you know, high reputation and cost-effective way to be able to penetrate these markets and do what we had done many years ago. And so that's how we came up with the idea. And then we got experts like Ben Davis, who's, you know, I asked him if it was a great idea or the dumbest idea in the world. And now we're bringing this thing to life. I think he thought it was an okay idea.
So, Ben, tell me about how you're rolling out this franchise model for Lendio.
So we've been looking at different ways that we could approach the rolling this out, because it is fairly new in this space, right? And so you've got to really make sure that you have the model created right. And we asked a lot of experts, brought in a lot of good people to kind of look at how we would approach this. And what we really think we will have achieved success in the franchising space when Brock kind of described this point in his business Funding Utah, where he became the guy that was known in the Utah area. If you were looking for that type of angel funding, he was the guy. He became kind of the branded guy that everyone would go to. When we have 400 of those, you know, 400 or 500 of those across the country, and we've connected to local communities, when our franchise owners and the Lendio brand and the local communities have become kind of the first name that is spoken or thought of when a small business owner asks another small business owner, or a professional service provider is asked by a small business owner, hey, I need some funding for this next phase of growth. When Lendio is the first name or brand that comes up, then we know we will have succeeded. So we've targeted as candidates for our franchise profile people that are connected to their local small business community, that have a demonstrated ability to build a Rolodex, you know, to connect well, have some strategic sales and marketing background, especially people that have, they don't necessarily need to have, you know, strong small business lending background, because our Lendio's proprietary system will do all of that. They need to have the ability to connect and create both relationships directly with small business borrowers and with local strategic partners.
So do you have some franchisees already on the platform?
We do. We just launched our first group of franchisees 2 weeks ago. We had them out to Salt Lake for a week of training. We have 5 markets that are open, 3 up in the Northeast, and then 2 down in Texas.
So 2017, do you think, two final questions, do you think you're going to pass the $1 billion mark this year, or is it going to be early next year, and what are your other plans for Lendio for the remainder of the year?
Yeah, so I think we're going to come right up on the edge. You know, if we look at our budget and our plan for 2017, it's to be able to, you know, we're going to be dangerously close to that $1 billion mark. Maybe it will depend on how well franchising does, right? Maybe that will take us, you know, sprinting past the mark. Hopefully so. But for us, you know, it's all around, you know, customer acquisition. We have a big focus on partnerships. We're pretty excited about this franchising strategy. And then, you know, getting our brand and through direct marketing. And so those are kind of our 3 major initiatives for 2017, is just continue to scale and grow the top of the funnel, or create more awareness for business owners across the U.S.
And how can people find out about what's happening with Lendio?
Lendio.com. Come see us.
Great. Well, thank you both, Ben and Brock, for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us, Brett. Appreciate it.
Okay, so let's go to a quick break. You are listening to Breaking Banks. Tweet us out at BreakingBanks1, or you can use my Twitter ID at Brett King as well. Be a part of the conversation. We'd love to have you join us. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back after this break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast, Temenos, has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
You are back with Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King.
We're here with Ohad Samet. He's the CEO, and I'm guessing the founder of a company called co-founder of True Accord. Tell me, what is True Accord, Ohad?
True Accord is a machine learning-based collection service. We developed an engine that replaces the majority of human-to-human interactions with human-to-machine interactions in the collection process. We offer this as a licensed collection agency working with banks and lenders and e-commerce companies in the U.S., basically collecting better than traditional collection agencies, reducing compliance issues, creating a much nicer experience, if such thing is possible, for debtors that owe money, and helping them pay their debt and leaving them with a better feeling than they would with a traditional experience.
Tell me about where your platform is at. I'm guessing you're live. And so tell me about the journey to here and where you guys are currently at.
Yeah, sure thing. So in terms of background, personally, I've been dealing with machine learning for financial services for more than 11 years now. Headed analytics for a company called Fraud Sciences. We did machine learning for e-commerce, got acquired by PayPal, spent a few years at PayPal, left, and through another acquisition of a startup we started, got to be the chief risk officer for Klarna and was acquainted closely with the debt collection issue as a way to make your numbers as a chief risk officer. And I feel that the same solutions we apply to credit granting and to fraud prevention could apply for debt collection. Got together with my co-founders. We started working in 2013. We launched in 2014. And now, 2.5 years later, we have about $1 billion going through our platform, more than 1 million consumers, with anyone from some e-commerce brands to subprime lenders to major issuers in the U.S. Unfortunately, just can't share their names because debt collection is always a sensitive thing for people to talk about. But it's going well. We're expanding quickly.
Now, more generally, in terms of AI and machine learning, what impact do you think this is going to have on the financial services space generally? In 10 years' time, how will AI have changed the world of banking and lending?
I'll admit to being a little bit of a cynic and not being on the forefront of using, all the buzzwords. And I think there are certain areas where banks are not yet ready to adopt technology. I'm not sure that the retail branch is going away, falling prey to machine learning and artificial intelligence. But the thing that we're seeing is we're already convinced, I think, in the industry that machine learning can be better at predicting behavior, whether you're going to pay, whether someone is a fraudster. What we're seeing at True Accord is that machine learning is also good at shaping behavior or directing behavior in a certain way. So you can equate that to, I want to be fit, but I don't want to go to the gym. Can machine learning help me turn that into a good habit? Turns out in the debt collection space, and I think in other areas where traditionally we thought only humans talk to humans, machine learning can help steer behavior that people want to adopt but can't because of distractions. And to me, that's going to be a big deal. A part of the relationship that's being replaced by very personalized experiences in the financial services industry.
So where's True Accord at in your funding cycle? How have you gone for raising money and what are your plans on that?
Yeah, we're a post-Series A company. Our ethos was always to be frugal and focus on top-line growth and good margins and being independent, spending money to grow rather than sustain the business. And we're focused on that.
And what are your plans for the rest of 2017?
Grow with our current clients. There's a lot to grow. Banks like to pilot and then expand. So we're post-pilot with some of our clients, which is great. We're adding two or three major issuers this year. Our vision as a company is to become the platform of choice for financial rehabilitation. We want not only to be the best collectors out there and help people pay debt with the money that they have, but also help them create value in a way that helps them pay debt with money that they didn't have initially. We're starting to experiment, and I hope that by the end of this year, we'll have a few channels that are effective in that way that we can offer to millions of consumers on top of really good collection practices. What I say is, compare a traditional collection agency to us the way you would compare a telemarketing campaign to a sophisticated inside sales department. With a traditional collection agency, even the best ones, you have hundreds and maybe thousands of collectors. They're paid very low base salary, and they're paid a commission. And they're expected to cold call consumers, get them on the phone, convince them to make a payment, and they make a percentage. They personally make a percentage out of each dollar once they hit their goals. So in essence, you get people who are low paid and dependent on collections for their livelihood, cold calling people, trying to convince them to do something. Not a great experience, even if you are the best intentioned person on this earth. Compare that with us. We have a system that's data-driven, now with more than a million consumers, hundreds of millions of interactions with consumers, that can look at a specific consumer and say, who in my platform is similar to them based on information I have about them? What worked with this consumer? Did I send an email and they responded? Did I send that letter and they responded? What was their browsing pattern on our website and what offers worked best for them? And then based on that, the system can start engaging. What day of the week, what time of the day, what content. We have different editorials, different approaches that people can relate to, different offers. It becomes a really complex matrix. And the system, based on historical data, can decide how to engage, track consumers' behavior in real time. Every email they open, every link they click, their browsing pattern, where did they drop off, did they talk to an agent, and what did they say, what was their disposition, and crunch all of that and decide what the next step should be. Essentially creating a personalized communication and collection strategy for a specific person. So it's not about being nice, it is about being targeted. And of course, we're not pushy, but some people need encouragement, some people need inspiration, some people need empathy, and that is the thing. It is about talking to someone in a voice that allows them to hear what you're saying more than pounding them with six phone calls a day.
I like that. Well, Ohad Samet from True Accord, thanks for joining us. How do people find out more about True Accord, particularly if you're a bank looking at the collections problem and want to apply some MI, machine intelligence, to it? How can we find out more?
Usually banks meet us at one of the conferences, or come and just look more at information on our website, or meet us at one of the best practices roundtables that some consultancy agencies organize. We even had a few inbounds to our website from major banks, so that was pretty exciting. We were all very excited as a team, and I hope to meet everyone at Lendit or at one of the future conferences for debt collection.
Ohad, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you very much.
So we're here with Christoph Rika from iWalker. So what is iWalker?
We're providing small business loans in the UK, Germany, and Poland, and by trying to solve that structural problem that has existed for a very, very long time, where small businesses simply don't get the access to capital that they should have to rise to their potential. And that's what we're about.
So the name iWalker, I-W-O-C-A, it's rather unusual. What's the derivation of it? Where does it come from?
It stands for instant working capital, and it was born in my living room. In fact, I was thinking working capital, what kind of name could we give it? Walker was already taken, and then out of that came iWalker to sort of put the focus at that we make the access as instant as possible.
And now, where are you living? Where do you live yourself?
In London.
So are you guys concerned about the Brexit having an impact on your business?
There are clearly concerns around Brexit. We're relieved, of course, as anyone else is, that so far the sentiment has held up so well, and we didn't see any repercussions on our customers, which is very positive. But we will see how the next 2 years go. The Theresa May is about to trigger Article 50, and then negotiations will start, and I think at that point some of the uncertainty hopefully will clear up that is around us.
So tell us about the platform iWorker, what and how you deliver to your end users.
So it's we started from the hypothesis that data is now available in a form that wasn't available in that same format 10, 15 years ago. And so we felt if we can gather information in a much more digital way than banks, then we're in a much better position in understanding the risk of our customers and also improve the user experience by making the entire flow for customers much easier. And so in essence, it's a very data-driven technology platform. We're collecting a lot of information in a completely automated and digital way from our customers when they sign up, which is a process that takes a few minutes. And then we're able to make decisions on financing a small business really either instantaneously or within hours of the application.
So tell me about that data that you collect. What data have you found to be really critical in this decision-making process to give customers a seamless experience, but also to limit or reduce the risk that you face as a fintech?
You know, clearly there's a lot of sort of secret sauce in there is our IP. And so typically commercial due diligence would be to go, for example, in a restaurant, eat the food, speak to the customers, look at the accounts, make financial analysis around this. So in essence, this is sort of what we have replicated. We just automated all of these processes. The principle that we're starting with is how can we make it just as efficient to immediately spot the really good points about the company and the points that are relatively weak. And that differs, of course, with the size of the company. So, you know, a company that turns over $75,000 per year is a very different company to one that turns over $1 million or $2 million. And the process that you need to have for both of those is different. And the information that is really relevant is, again, differing. And so we're looking, you know, across a broad spectrum of data, ranging from business credits to the credit of the owner or main controller of the company, and all of the business related activities that I mentioned before.
Now, is the onus on the customer to give you all that data, or are you guys using other sources of data as well?
Both. I mean, clearly, data that is publicly available, we can look at. And then clearly there are a lot of sources of information where our customer proactively gives us access to that.
What's the average loan size that you're looking at?
So we go from £1,000 to £100,000, and therefore have a very wide range. But the majority of our customers would come from the long tail, and so the average is about £15,000.
So what are the key skills for a lending or a credit business for the future? Because it used to be the ability to assess credit risk and loan officers and modeling and things like that. But what are the skills that are going to differentiate a lending business over the next decade?
I mean, any start kind of saw like three sort of core elements of success for a lending business. The first one is, of course, as with any business in the world, to have an attractive product offering that make some customers coming to you. So customer acquisition is a very important one. The second really core one is to be able to run efficient operations. And of course, part of that is having a very, very, very good risk management system behind it. So it's the data collection, it's the data analysis and process management around that. And the third one is funding. And funding is another key element for any lending business to make sure that you have stable funding sources at competitive prices. So these three things, you know, you still need to master. I think in levels of difficulty, I would say funding is significantly easier to get. There's a lot less competitive advantages in the pure funding side. It's quite easy to replicate. There's a lot less IP in there, and it's much more about the first and the second, and how the first sort of is combined with the second. One way is the way how your marketing is already driven by your operations and by your risk management.
Thank you for joining us on Breaking Banks today, and all the best with the conference.
Thank you very much.
So we are here with the creator the founder of the Lendit Conference, Peter Renton. G'day, mate.
G'day, Brett.
Now, you're originally from Australia, but you've been offshore a long time. Where in Oz are you from originally?
From Sydney.
So I'm a Melbourne boy, mate. So
Sydney's better than Melbourne, you know.
That's what they say, right?
Yes, that's what they say, because it's the truth.
But, you know, so the one stat I always used to say, you know, because they always complain about Melbourne, it was cold and rainy, but you actually get more rain in Sydney than in Melbourne, right?
Yeah, but I think there's probably more rainy days or more miserable days in Melbourne than there are in Sydney.
Miserable days. Okay, well, let's get on to Lendit. So an Aussie here in New York, you know, one of the biggest fintech conferences in the world, certainly the biggest lending conference in the fintech space. How did this all come about? Where did you get the idea for this event?
So it's funny because this actually came about really out of my blogging days when I started Lend Academy, just focusing on the peer-to-peer lending space. And really was writing about it, built a community, and then people were saying, you know, we really should all get together in person. We only know each other online. And just when I'd sort of decided that I wanted to start a conference, I got a cold call from my now co-founders saying, hey, do you want to start a conference with us? We want to start a peer-to-peer, we're an online lending conference. And I said, funny you should say that, because that's what I actually want to do. So we all, you know, we had a conference call, we had, you know, we met together in person, and we started the business.
Yeah, it was interesting. We did sort of that straw man poll in the session this morning I had with Anthony, and asked, and it was sort of, you know, you had about half the room who were techie and half the room that were traditional finance people. So it seems like you've sort of been able to get that mix.
Yeah, I think when we started out, it was, you know, really all of the early adopters. So it was more sort of the technology type people. But now what's changed over time is we're getting now traditional banking. I mean, you were interviewing the former CEO of Barclays, and what we're finding is that all of the large banks here, we've got all the top 10 banks, they've all sent people here, and they all are, you know, trying to figure out fintech. What am I going to do? How are we going to, you know, how are we going to sort of position our business so it's not irrelevant in 10 years?
Key element of this event, I think, that, and you give me your perspective on that, but it seems like there are people coming looking for answers right now, whereas before it was, well, we're not sure if this is going to be of impact, and now it's sort of a given that things are changing, and the question is, what do we do next?
Yeah, that's a real difference with this event. We've had in the past, we've had, you know, the bankers coming, they're just here to learn, they said. We're not really, don't have any agenda, they're just here to learn, and now they're here to say, we're here to really, we want to implement a plan, we've got to do something. I think that's a real difference, because as you say, you know, finance is being disrupted. It's everyone sees what's happened in other industries, and you know, the large banks don't want to be irrelevant in 10 years time, and they realize unless they actually start to have a plan and really implement a plan, they're going to be left behind.
And what's been hot at the event this year?
I think what's been really it's sort of woven through many, many sessions is artificial intelligence. I mean, we had the IBM Watson guys out doing, I don't know whether you saw it, it was a pretty amazing, they had this sort of avatar person, woman on the screen that was communicating in real time with one of the IBM people. And so, I mean, that was one really obvious example, but it's, you just go into the credit and underwriting and they're talking about artificial intelligence there. You're going into the, you know, small business lending and they're talking about artificial intelligence there. It feels like it's, you know, I think last year it was mentioned, you know, a little bit, but here it just seems like in the last 12 months that's become a really hot topic.
So what's on the cards for you for the rest of 2017?
So 2017, we have, obviously after this conference, we turn our attention to China. We have our Lundi FinTech conference that we host in Shanghai, July 15th and 16th. It will bring probably 100, 150 Westerners out there, and then we'll have the Chinese, will all come to that. So that's our next event. After that, we have our London event in October 9th and 10th, and you know, you can, you know, join our mailing list. We have Lendit News, which we just launched here, which is a daily news digest of, you know, the top 15 or 20 news stories in fintech. We're pushing that out, you know, Monday to Friday every week, and we're actually getting that translated into Chinese, and it's going out in China every day as well. And so that's really the connecting with Lendit through Lendit News, through the main Lendit site, coming to an event. That's that's how you can connect with us.
Tag Lendit USA or Lendit 2017.
Hashtag Lendit USA.
Very good. Well, thanks, Cobber. Thanks for joining us on the show this week at Breaking Banks.
My pleasure, Brett. Thanks.
So wandering the halls of the Jarvis Center, I've run into two old mates from Asia, Emmanuel Daniel. Say hi.
Hi. Hi. Good to see you again.
Absolutely. And John Owens.
Great to see you, Brett.
Now, John, you're technically based back here in Florida now, but you spent a long time in the Philippines and Asia on financial inclusion with the... who were you with back then?
Well, I was working with the Alliance for Financial Inclusion for a while. It was based in Thailand and then moved to Malaysia, but also did a lot of work for years with the Central Bank in the Philippines.
And Ed, of course, you are the founder and you run the Asian Banking business, the Asian Banker, Asian Banking Journal, and so forth. Now, what are you doing here at Lendit?
Well, I think Lendit is the future of lending. I came partially because I wanted to learn more a little bit about where peer-to-peer lending is. And as you can see, there's lots of Chinese peer-to-peer lenders at Lendit. But I think what I'm seeing is that the whole foundations of the lending business, regardless of who you are, whether you're a bank or a marketplace lender, as the Americans are calling it now, is fundamentally being rocked to the bottom. So I'm glad to be here.
And John, you mentioned to me that you're happy to see some financial inclusion content on the event this year. So, you know, where are we getting a social conscience in lending? Where's that coming from?
Well, I'm not sure where the organizers decided, but I think it's great to see that I think, you know, people realize there's a business opportunity at the base of the economic pyramid. So financial inclusion is both a social good as well as being good business. So we're seeing more interest in that. And I'd also like to add, you know, there's a lot of emphasis now with all these new players on responsible digital finance or responsible online lending. So a lot of discussion about, you know, when we're talking about a combined bringing people for the first time into providing financial services or banking and doing that digitally, we need to be careful about doing that. So I think there's a lot of responsible lending consciousness and discussion, and that's good to see here.
So Ed, what else is hot at Lendit this year?
Brad, one of the things I do very well now, and I think I see my responsibility to the industry, is taking a brief as to how frontier technology is being interpreted in Asia as opposed to in the US. And there's a fundamental difference. I spoke with Ron Suber, with Paul Hittite, Saul Hittite, and some of the other big guys. And it's interesting how the US model keeps very close to the script, which is the lending business, whereas in Asia, we've actually built so much more interesting diversions, supply chain, payments, wealth management. And I still have this question in the back of my head, why are the Asians a lot more free about how they want to interpret where this platform is going to take them, and why are the U.S. the U.S. players still very stuck in a kind of a purist growth.
So just to finish up, guys, I know John, you recently took a tour with some of the in the last couple of years, you're saying taking the central bankers to learn about P2P and markets like Peru and so forth. But in terms of this sort of first principles approach to lending, what is interesting, on a global basis? Where are the hot markets?
Well, I think Asia, as Emmanuel said, is really an innovator. I think there was a lot of discussion here about looking at financial life cycles and kind of looking more at the whole financial needs of people rather than credit alone. So I think there is increasing. I think Asia spends a lot of time on that. I think Africa, particularly, digital, when we look at digital financial inclusion, the two big leaders in that would be kind of the East African markets, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and then, of course, China.
All right, now finally, Ed, you got your new book coming out. It's almost done. We've been talking about it for a while. What's the book title and when's it out?
Well, the tentative title is The Winning Bank, and it's called The Winning Bank only to keep it very simple. But what it is taking how the industry has evolved since 1971, which I think is the time when banking started to become what it is today, and how much of the DNA that was actually perfected in banking is applicable in the alternative financing world today.
Well, we hope you'll be winning. Is that like Charlie Sheen, winning with your winning bank? But
It's good to see you, Brad.
Good to see you, Ed. Thanks, Ed and John, for joining us on Breaking Banks. Well, that's the show for this week. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. Don't forget, guys, please go to iTunes. Give us a 5-star review for the show. Put a review online. Tweet us out at BreakingBanks1. Put it up on Facebook. Just give us some love. Show us some love. But thank you for listening again this week to Breaking Banks. And if you want to check out some of our previous episodes, don't forget you can go to BreakingBanks.com and check it out. I'll see some of you next week down in Miami at Temenos Innovation Jam and in a couple of weeks in London. But thanks for listening again to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. See you later.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.